This edition of The Review was first broadcast on Saturday, the 23rd of March, 2013, on Monocle 24.
Hello and welcome to The Review, your weekly preview and review of the arts here on Monocle 24, coming to you from Studio One at Midori House with me, Andrew Muller, and Clemency Burton-Hill.
Coming up on today's programme, we're delving into the world of design. As the Design of the Year exhibition opens here in London, we'll ask judge and editor-in-chief of Diseño, Johanna Argerman-Ross, just how significant the exhibition is in a global context.
We'll also be welcoming back Nick Luscombe, founder of Musicity, to pick out some new international music for us.
And we'll be exploring what sort of cultural highlights can be found this weekend in Managua, Nicaragua.
Managua's majestic volcano is a namesake for one of Nicaragua's most celebrated bands, Momotombo, whose explosive rhythms will caravan through the capital's hottest and newest spot, Urucali.
Plus, author Oliver Bullough will be joining us to talk us through some new writing from and about Russia and the Caucasus, including his terrific new book, The Last Man in Russia. So lots to look forward to this week on The Review here on Monocle 24. And welcome to The Review and welcome to Studio One at Midori House. Good afternoon, Clemency.
Hi, Andrew. I'm very excited because this is the first time that you and I have ever hosted a show together.
It is. It was bound to happen sooner or later,
I'm sure. I'm very glad it's this one as well because there's lots of exciting things to look forward to and talk about.
There are. You have been actually culturally active quite recently, I believe.
As recently as this morning. Yeah, I've hot-footed it over from the Royal College of Art here in London, the Dyson Building. It's the RCA Secrets, which is a huge event in the art world every year where many artists, 2,000 postcards are created by artists.
This is their annual lucky dip, basically.
Yeah, their annual lucky dip, of which I think every penny pretty much goes to supporting the Royal College of Art Fund, which obviously provides scholarships for up-and-coming artists and students at the college. But what's great about it is that, you know, it's completely anonymous. So you might get a Damien Hirst, you might get a Tracy Emin or a Paula Rego, or you might get a student at the Royal College of Art. But of course, that's great anyway, because they might turn out to be the Damien Hirst or the David Hockney of their day. So I've come from that, which is always, I mean, it was utterly miserable. Some people have been queuing and camping out in Battersea at the Royal College of Art Dyson Building since last Tuesday. And here in London, we're having weather, which, you know, if it was the middle of winter in Russia, which we'll be talking about later, you wouldn't be surprised. It's absolutely arctic. So it was real dedication. It shows that people really do care about contemporary art still, and they're excited to bag a bargain for 45 quid.
Do you think people really care about contemporary art, or do they care about that possibility that they'll spend £45 on something that might be worth thousands? Because presumably the guessing game is to go in there with your 45 quid and try and spot which one is by the megastar.
I think some people definitely approach it as, oh, I'm going to try and get a really famous artist and then my 45 quid will be worth a lot more on eBay by the time it gets home. And you're allowed to buy up to four postcards. So you're going to spend, you know, 180 quid and get four works of art. But I honestly think that most people do it because it's a chance to get a great piece of contemporary art for very little money. You're obviously supporting a fantastic cause. And if you're lucky enough, but you know, my brother, who does this every year religiously and has over the years bagged Damien Hirst's, Tracy Emin's, Paula Rego, he wouldn't dream of selling them. So I think, you know, for him, it's definitely all about being able to buy a piece of art that he would never otherwise be able to afford, for example. So it's pretty cool, though, I have to say.
It's a kind of a vast annual upscale scratch card lottery, really, isn't it? It is interesting. Did you buy anything? I'm just looking at the postcards available.
Well, I didn't this year because I wasn't able to camp overnight, but they do a raffle now, and my husband was very lucky. He managed to get into the raffle ticket, so he bagged us a series of postcards by an artist called Gordon Chung, which he's very happy about. So that was pretty cool. What about you, Andrew? You've been reading a lot, I know, this week.
I've mostly been reading books about Russia for the last item today. Later in the show, we will be talking about books about Russia. So if I sound to any of our listeners more than usually gloomy, that's the reason. It's because I've been reading lots of books about Russia.
You need to hotfoot it over to the LSO St. Luke's tonight, which is celebrating its 10th anniversary with a very, very exciting concert by the chamber orchestra Aurora, who I think are pretty much the most exciting classical music outfit in the world anywhere at the moment. They're doing a concert called Insomnia, And, you know, there's a piece on there by James McMillan called A Deep but Dazzling Darkness, which I think would, you know, put a new spin on the dark gloominess of the Russian books you've been reading.
The Russian books, as you have mentioned, there have at least been suited by the weather in London, which, you know, it's at least it's good weather for listening to the radio. And you are indeed listening to The Review on Monocle 24. We'll be back shortly.
Well, we're starting out today in the world of design because this week in London, the annual Design of the Year exhibition opened its doors. Modestly described as the Oscars of the design world, the awards and exhibition seek to showcase the most innovative and imaginative international design, from architecture to transport, furniture to fashion.
This year's shortlist is wide-ranging, from a ketchup bottle that stops the sauce from sticking on the inside to Cola Life, a project which is utilising Coca-Cola's distribution network to get medicine to remote areas of Africa. There's also Thomas Heatherwick's Olympic Cauldron, Renzo Piano's Shard, a camera from US company Lito which enables you to refocus your pictures after taking them, and self-adjustable glasses for children in the developing world.
The winners are going to be announced on the 17th of April, and one of the women who's been shut behind closed doors all this week is Johanna Argman-Ross, founder and editor-in-chief of Disegno magazine, one of the judges of the Design of the Year award. I'm delighted to say that she joins us in the studio now to tell us more about this exhibition and the competition and how significant it is, and also just to talk about some current trends in design. Welcome, Johanna. Thank you so much for joining us this morning.
Thank you for having me.
First of all, tell us how your experience has been. I mean, I know that we can't talk about specific items because you have been locked away judging them, but is this really the Oscars of the design world?
Well, I mean, there are very few other shows that do this in the world in general. Mostly, when you look at annual design reviews, they tend to be focused on national shows. For example, in Sweden, there's a big design show every year, in the United States to do something similar. But the Design Museum is really here looking at the international design and architecture industries and trying to put them all into one exhibition. It's a very ambitious pursuit, which I think works quite well as a review, as an overview of what's been going on over the last year and what the preoccupations are of designers and architects working out there at the moment. But, you know, to call it the Oscars, that's sort of just to put a kind of positive media spin on it, isn't it? I wouldn't say it is.
What are you looking for in a winner? Because it's such a vast exhibition and there's so many diverse ideas and themes in it. How do you go about comparing, say, and they are all brilliant and amazing, but there's one that we mentioned there, the Liquiglide ketchup bottle, which is a solution to, you know, a universal but nonetheless fairly minor irritant in the grand scheme of things, to something like the self-adjustable glasses for children in the developing world, which is potentially world-altering and revolutionary. How do you make a judgment between those extremes?
It's very difficult, and I don't think that any of us find it a very easy experience because, as you say, the breadth is very vast. I mean, it's vast in terms of you looking at the Shard next to performance architecture work called IKEA. Actually, I can't remember the full name of it now, but it's extraordinarily different, and they're working in very different fields. However, you can still, I suppose, sense the kind of, basically take the temperature and the pulse of the architecture or design world, which I think is a really useful thing to do, you know, whether that's a brand new building or looking at architecture in a completely new way, such as the Home for All project did in Japan post-tsunami that also won the Golden Lion in Venice last year. Of course, we all agree that it's difficult as judges to compare them all together and put them on the same level. But at the same time, I think that things do stand out for their specific achievement or who they reach. For example, you mentioned Cola Life before. It's, of course, an extraordinarily important project which involves design, but it's also not necessarily design as in making things look pretty, but it's using design as a problem solver. How do you, you know, solve the problem of diarrhea epidemics in Africa, where people don't really have access to cleaning their hands and taking very, very, very simple medication? It's using an existing distribution network, which is through Coca-Cola bottles, which seems that regardless of how remote you are, it seems that Coca-Cola is reaching those communities. which in itself is maybe a little bit disturbing. But here is a designer that's been looking at, you know, that particular, actually, in fact, that particular space that appears between glass bottles to fit in a kit which contains everything you need to cure or prevent diarrhea within these places. So, you know, something like that obviously stands out as a really, really interesting project. But likewise, there's some beauty aesthetically in there as well. For example, there's a beautiful set by Eugen Ironware by Jasper Morrison, which is utilizing centuries-old craftsmanship from Japan to create something new and contemporary. Of course, you know, in terms of the good it does for, you know, humans, it's not comparable, but of course it's equally important that we, you know, push forward good design and good aesthetics, but also, you know, keeping craftsmanship and industries alive that potentially otherwise wouldn't be. So, well, to sort of try and end and answer your question, it is difficult, but I think it can be done. And I think that from what I've experienced this week, I think we did it in a very useful and a very good way. We have had a very good process of reaching our conclusions.
And in general, in the design world, you mentioned taking the pulse. Is it in rude health? How does this compare to other years? Because obviously it's a very bleak picture for many artists and creative communities at the moment, with the economy being what it is.
It's definitely, I mean, well, the designs of the year have really been running ever since the recession hit. So I don't think that there's any kind of massive changes from that point of view. I think that over the last 5 years, designers, architects have been working within a recession mode. I do think that it sort of maybe cuts off the sort of fat and sort of makes people focus a bit more. And I think that that's reflected quite well this year in the selection of the projects that are showing. There's a really interesting project, in fact, from outside of Paris, which is called Tourbois le Prêtre, which is basically regenerating a tower block which was very run down, built in the 60s, that was threatened with demolition. But instead of demolishing it, which is a very costly exercise, the architects working with it, Frédéric Drouot and Anne Location, were putting balconies onto the existing structure and basically creating more space within a tower block that's already existing, which was a much more time-efficient, cost-efficient way of regenerating something that otherwise would sort of just have been demolished and put people's lives within this area sort of at much more disruption than it now did. So things like that are very interesting. You know, it's something that probably 10 years ago you wouldn't see in an exhibition like this, because I think that architecture had very different preoccupations then, to do with, you know, icons and buildings that sort of really drew tourists or really created the name of an architect rather than kind of helping communities.
You mentioned that a sort of focus engendered by the world's slightly straightened economic circumstances. Are you noticing that, you know, as this competition goes year by year, that different themes emerge in different years? And are you noticing any sort of particular themes emerging this year?
I think that preoccupation, I think, with society in general, I mean, design which connects with the world is definitely something which I think runs through this year in terms of the projects that have been nominated. I think actually usefully the show itself is divided into various different themes. So instead of being displayed within the different categories, you know, architectural, digital design, product design, it actually within itself creates themes of what's been going on. So there's a thing which is sort of looking backwards. There's actually quite a lot of retro styled products in this year, or technologies that can seem slightly dated, such as a postcard player, which, you know, it's very in this day and age of iPods and iPhones, and actually iPods are even outdated, so yeah, iPhones and new music playing technologies, you know, a postcard which plays music, which you need a specific device for, seems quite outmoded. But there is this kind of nostalgic mode as well, I think, within the design. Well, actually, not within the design world. I think within the world in general, you know, we do really look back and look to old technologies and kind of reminisce that maybe things were a bit better before. So that's something that I think runs through it. And I think that the different divisions of these themes within the show creates a really nice view of the exhibition for the visitor, because it kind of plays it down into four or five different movements over the last year, which I think is really helpful if you're not, you know, an expert in what's going on within the design world.
There are 99 items that have been shortlisted and they go on display at the Design Museum from tomorrow. What will it mean for those who win? What difference does it make to them?
I think that obviously it depends on a little bit. If you're already a recognised designer, such as last year, Barbara Oscoby won with the Olympic torch, you know, it was obviously something which they felt very proud of, but it didn't necessarily change their, you know, their practice or the reputation that they already had, which is already kind of a very high profile. I think that the year before that, it was a winner, a former Royal College of Art graduate who invented the folding plug. Obviously, that sort of really had a big impact on him and his life and work as a designer. So I think that it can go either way. And I think just being nominated, I think, is a big help for a lot of the people that are in there. It's interesting to see that there are actually a lot of recent graduates showing, and there's a lot of recent graduates' work being nominated, which shows that, you know, the design schools such as Royal College of Art or Eindhoven Design Academy, they're doing some really, really good work and developing sort of designers and architects for the future, which again, is the show is interesting for.
Johanna Agerman-Ross, founder and editor-in-chief of Desenio, thank you very much for joining us here on the review. The winners of Design of the Year will be announced on the 17th of April. And if you're in London, the exhibition is on at the Design Museum until the 7th of July.
I will most certainly be hot-footing it over there. Thanks again for joining us. This is the review on Monocle 24. Stay with us, because after this very short break, we will be exploring some weekend cultural highlights from all around the world.
Each Sunday on Monocle 24, we like to take stock.
The wonder of history for the journalist is you can delve into this immense booty of information.
I don't even know what to think about that.
Take the global pulse.
I was at a Bunga Bunga party the other day.
And?
I wasn't at all. I just wanted to start a show like that. We're at 187 shows down. How's your week been?
I'm feeling 187, actually.
And occasionally take things down a notch, too.
I had a pair of plum suede loafers with gold snaffles. And a guy stopped his car and leant out of the window and said it was people like me who were bringing this country to its knees.
To end the week with the best chat.
We know that he had them and we know that he used them before.
Because we still had the receipts.
Well, there's that.
Some great music.
Do you know, I never thought that I might need to have a question about death metal, but I'm warming up.
And some good fun to set up Sunday and warm the week ahead. The Monocle Weekly. Your week starts here.
Welcome back to the review here on Monocle 24 with me, Andrew Muller, and Clemency Burton Hill. It's time now to cross to Associate Editor Nelly Gocheva to hear some cultural treats she's dug out from around the world for us this weekend.
This weekend in Rotterdam, Museum Boijmans van Bjanningen plays host to the work of Norwegian artist Hariton Pushwagner. This is Pushwagner's first solo exhibition outside of Norway, featuring illustrations and paintings by the artist known to his countrymen as the contemporary Munch. Entitled Soft City, the exhibit is on until the 26th of May. Two exhibitions opened earlier this week at Brand New Gallery in Milan. First, check out Splays, featuring prints and sculptures by London native Gabriel Hartley. Then, head over to Gallery 2 to see Gemini, London-based artist Roman Liska's debut exhibition in Italy, featuring painted white and black blocks and metal sculptures. The exhibitions are on until the 11th of May. This week in Tokyo welcomes G Tokyo, a two-day contemporary art fair taking place in Roppongi. The fair features an eclectic mix of works submitted by Japan's top galleries. Highlights include Yoyoki Kusama's flower sculpture, a gold-plated cardboard piece by Tan Vo, and the latest by Matthew Derbyshire, who rose to fame with his designs for Freeze projects. For more details, go to gtokyo-art.com. The 42nd edition of New Directors, New Films started earlier this week in New York. Co-produced by the Museum of Modern Art and the Film Society of Lincoln Center, the festival is renowned for presenting the future faces of filmmaking. Films to look out for include The Act of Killing by Joshua Oppenheimer and Austrian drama The Shine of Day by Tiza Kovi and Rainer Friemel. For more information on the program, visit newdirectors.org. And finally, this weekend, we'll be listening to Danish trio Efterklang. The band is in New York's Bowery Ballroom tonight before hitting London's Royal Albert Hall on Thursday. And now let's hear Apples.
Another way to your heart. We start to look like seconds.
For Monocle, I'm Nelly Gotcheva.
The more you take to yourself, the more you take it away. We settle in to your fear. We start to look like echoes, and then we're all.
Was Apples by Efterklang, ending that report there by Nelly Gotcheva.
And we will continue with the music theme because it's time now for our weekly music review. And today we welcome back DJ and presenter Nick Luscombe to the review.
Hello.
Hello, Nick. Thanks for joining us. You've made your name as the presenter of Flow Motion, broadcasting a mix of deep electronica, dub and eclectic music on BBC Radio 3's Late Junction and London's Resonance FM and XFM, as well as advising brands on their music content. You also, of course, have a long-standing relationship with the Japanese music scene, and starting on April the 6th, Nick's going to be hosting a weekly show every Saturday from 5pm on Tokyo's Inter FM. Very warm welcome back to you. Great to see you. So let's...
Thank you.
Start talking about your show in Japan. Tell us briefly about that.
Yeah, God, you're really well informed, aren't you? It's amazing. But
you sound surprised. just to reiterate, it's on Inter FM at 5 p.m.
That's it. Exactly. You got the whole story.
Somebody should have let you know about this. Yeah. What sort of music will you be playing, and ideally to whom?
Yeah, well, Inter FM is I guess one of the big three Tokyo stations. You know, which is fantastic for me to be on. I'm really really happy to be part of that lineup. They've had a big change there, and they've got a kind of new musical direction, which is great. I think they're going to really be exploring music with kind of people who are really into music, which is really useful. My show will be a kind of, I don't know, like a big mix of, you know, from electronica to jazz to world music, going back in time. The first show's got tracks by Joni Mitchell, I think, and I've been putting together the playlists already. So, just a very broad mix, but hopefully keeping it kind of, I don't know, something that really appeals to a lot of people in Japan, and keeping it quite modern as well, which is really important.
Will you be presenting that from here or from there?
From here, yeah. So I'll be recording it here, and then I'll be emailing it to them every week.
That would be quite a commute for a Saturday afternoon show, wouldn't it? Seeing as the rest
tricky.
Of your life is here.
Air miles would be good, though, but yeah.
Well, let's start. Let's have a listen to some of your tracks that you've chosen for us today. Should we start with Black or White?
Yeah, so this is, I just got this a couple of days ago on the excellent Wawa 45's record label, which is, it's been going for a little while now, run by Mr. Dom Savini, and always releasing just incredible music. And this is a new artist that he's picked up, Lee Lee. Remixed by this Japanese guy called Goth Trad, who's like sonically one of the most interesting of the kind of, it's hard to say dubstep these days, but that kind of world of music, sort of bass-driven music. He's done a remix of this track, and I just think it's really, really good.
Okay, well, let's give that a listen.
Picture.
That was the goth trad remix of Black or White by Lia Lia. I'm not alone, apparently, in thinking that has more than a whiff of Massive Attack circa Unfinished Sympathy about it.
Yeah, I think you're right. I think, I don't know how goth trad is, but obviously he's influenced by a lot of music for sure, and I guess the Bristol sound is something that's always influenced dubstep, so, you know, it's related, isn't it? Definitely.
That bass is quite something, though, isn't it?
It is, yeah. He's really well known for his bass, actually. I mean, he's an incredible producer. You have to really, really listen to his music, and, you know, it's kind of head and shoulders above a lot of those producers, I think, personally.
The next track you've picked for us, this is probably one of the more terrifying phrases in the English language, Norwegian experimental jazz. But this is Jager Jazzist with the Britten Sinfonia. How did this collaboration occur?
So this was my colleague on Radio 3, Fiona Talkington. She put a series together called Connections, which is all about fusing the best of Norwegian experimental avant-garde jazz.
Andrew was a subscription ticket holder for that series.
Yeah. And you know, folk music and the wide sort of, you know, amount of new music coming out of Norway. Fusing that with some of her favourite artists and the performers from the UK and trying to kind of create this kind of, you know, really interesting fusion basically between the two countries musically. She put together, I mean, for me, Jager Jazzist, I have to say, like the best band I've ever seen live. I saw them at the Spitz in London about 10 years ago, and I've been a fan ever since.
They're so kind of unclassifiable as well, aren't they?
They're
really
completely
sort of maverick and
totally, yeah,
fluid and extraordinary.
Yeah, it's really hard to pigeonhole what they do, and there's so many of them as well. And Fiona thought it'd be a cool idea to put them together with the Britten Sinfonia at the Barbican to do all the music, but with the Britten Sinfonia working with them. And I went along to the gig, and it was
really,
it was incredible, spine-tingling music.
I love this because for me, the Britten Sinfonia, well, I was mentioning Aurora earlier as a chamber orchestra in London, but the Britten Sinfonia based in Cambridge, just for me, such an incredible example of what classical music can be because they're so eclectic in their approach. They obviously, you know, they've just celebrated their 20th anniversary and they've been around for a while, but they still seem to me to be one of the most inventive outfits out there.
Yeah.
And, you know, I love this collaboration. I think it's absolutely fantastic.
I don't think it would work with everybody, but they did absolutely manage to make it happen, yeah.
And for those of us who are sort of musical omnivores and love so many different sounds, and as you say, the collaborations between, the connections between different sounds, this was I think I'm glad you picked this one. Should we have a listen?
Yeah.
Was Jager Jazzist and the Britten Sinfonia, Kitty Wu. That's that whole Norwegian experimental jazz British chamber orchestra crossover thing.
That whole thing. Quite a tired genre, I feel.
Yeah,
everyone's doing it.
It is pretty much over at this point, I think, the Norwegian jazz British chamber orchestra crossover. But it was, I think we can agree, fun while it lasted. Your third choice today, Jardine.
Jardine, yeah. She's, what can I say? She's from Hackney, and
therefore great.
Yeah, right, exactly. Yeah, we've got Japan, Norway, and Hackney. It's all we need in this show, right? Anything else? She's just a brilliant singer who's kind of just on the way up. You know, Ninja Tune have spotted her, and that's always a good thing, I think. So she's in, you know, in the same label as Yaga Yaz is here in the UK. Yeah, I saw her play live at the 100 Club a couple of years ago, and then just kind of got in touch with her. She made a track for a project I've been developing as well. And she's created this new track, which is a free download on her website, which was originally put together by Jacques Green and this guy called Corliss. And she basically sang over the top of the track. That's pretty much it. So a lot of people might recognise this already, but she does it so well. And her voice is incredible.
I was looking at the lyrics of this. They're rather sort of dreamy and philosophical, aren't they? I was such a dreamer. Whatever happened to me followed all the arrows. Child of the silence. Sounds go undetected. Let's listen to some of those sounds. Let's have a little spin.
That was Jardine with Arrows, the third choice of our musical guest today, Nick Luscombe. We should mention, as you were just saying, that is available as a free download from her website, but you're not going to find it, I don't think, unless we spell her name out. So it's you need to go to www.szjerdene, and Arrows is available as a free download. Move on to your fourth and final choice today, Jay's B with Grandma. Who are Jay's B?
So Jay's B are a Japanese jazz group that have been around for about 10 years. They've just released a new album. It's coming out in the UK. I think it's the first time they've been released in the UK on Far Out Recordings, which is well known for its Brazilian, great Brazilian music, but, you know, very eclectic over the years. Just an incredible album. Great great to see Japanese jazz being sort of promoted here in the UK again, because there's so much going on there that it's really hard to find out about, you know, and Far Out have done it again. They've highlighted some more great music that we would never have known about otherwise, possibly.
Giles Peterson on BBC Six Music was certainly saying that this is kind of jazz refreshed for everyone to sort of feel. So how important is it, do you think, that with a sort of very Western art form like jazz, in a way, that, you know, there is that refreshment of it by an Eastern, with Eastern flavours?
Yeah, I guess, you know, I mean, the Japanese have always been incredibly prolific at making fantastic jazz, you know, and there's so many great examples over the years. And it's just brilliant that the, you know, younger guys are doing this as well. And, you know, it's always been crossed over into all kinds of other genres. But this is just really refreshing, like you said, and really modern. I think it is important because, especially with this group have been together for a while, but this album was a sort of reflection on the whole kind of post-tsunami, like, you know, as a lot of artists were doing at the time. But
the album is called Isotope.
Yeah, that's it.
I guess there's the significance.
Yeah.
And an interesting track called Grandma, which is referring to the yacht that was used, of course, in the Cuban Revolution in 1956 by Fidel Castro and Che Guevara.
Yeah.
Another interesting cultural influence that you wouldn't necessarily expect.
That's that whole Japanese jazz Cuban communism crossover thing.
Yeah, that's the one, isn't it?
I mean, you just chose such predictable music for us this morning.
Yeah, I'm really sorry about that. Yeah.
Let's have a listen to that extraordinary confection.
Before we do that, we will say thank you to Nick Luscombe for coming in. But playing us out, this is Jay's B with their homage to the boat that bore Castro to revolution. It's Grandma. That was Jay's B with Grandma, the final choice of this week's musical guest, Nick Luscombe from Musa City. And you'll be able to hear Nick's new show on Tokyo's Inter FM from April the 6th.
You're listening to The Review on Monocle 24, and it's time now to spin the globe and cross over to a city somewhere else in the world and hear what's coming up there over the next few days. Today, the pin lands on Managua in Nicaragua, and our reporter Michael Rose is here to guide us through it.
If you're curiously seeking out Nicaragua's cultural events for the week ahead, there are plenty of options. In the coming days, Nicaragua's cultural calendar is well prepared for Holy Week, a 7-day national holiday beginning this weekend in the nation's capital. Managua's majestic volcano is a namesake for one of Nicaragua's most celebrated bands, Momotombo, whose explosive rhythms will caravan through the capital's hottest and newest spot, Urucali. Deriving its name from the nation's Nahuatl roots, this perched lounge setting will surely light up your weekend. Cost is 100 cordobas at the door. Highly crafted artisanal woodworks are part of the Nicaraguan cultural patrimony, as are the fine puppets that echo a tradition the country is struggling to keep alive. As a result, the nation's puppet theater, Guachipilin, is staging a night celebrating the fine art of Nicaraguan puppetry. The capital's newest cultural hub, bar, and art space, Cultura Quilombo, is proud to host Piratas, celebrating string entertainment revival. Puppetry like never before, this March 23rd at 3 p.m. 40 cordobas upon arrival. Cultura Quilombo will also be hosting a photo exhibit titled Mesawir, chronicling the lives of Nicaraguan youth. Atelier Favela provides artistic, photographic, and mentorship opportunities to talented urban youth with their work threading together visual tales of young Nicaraguan lives. Universal themes will be complemented by Afro-Nicaraguan reggae ensemble Liberación, hailing from the nation's Atlantic Caribbean coast. Ultra-private Escamequita Beach, located 30 minutes east of well-known San Juan del Sur, hosts DJ Steve Aoki this Thursday, March 28th. Aoki will be electrifying the stage as it kicks off the 16-hour festival under the afternoon sun, dubbed Escamequita Electrofest. Presented by Nicaraguan promoters Spins Productions and Craft Creativos, congregants gain access to the region's most notorious DJs including Chiricano, Revuelta Sonora, and up-and-coming superstar DJ Luigi. Tickets range from $20 US to $50 VIP. And the finest Latin American DJs come together in San Juan del Sur as the nation escapes the capital this Holy Week. Nicaraguans DJ Revuelta Sonora and VJ Zurial join Guatemala's DJ Redpoint and VJ Piloy of Costa Rica for an afternoon fiesta of Latin proportions. Beginning at 4 p.m. and absolutely free, the celebrations held at Bar Arribas won't disappoint. For more information, visit revueltasonora.com. For Monocle in Managua, Nicaragua, I'm Michael Reyes.
And you're listening to The Review on Monocle 24. We will be back after this short break to talk Russian literature with award-winning writer Oliver Bullo.
From the historic center of pencil making to the world's biggest trade fair, Monocle Films profiles a pioneering German stationery brand taking the pencil into the 21st century.
It is more or less in our genes to make pencils. And behind this is not only the region of Nuremberg, it's also the German type of engineering, of really digging deep into things, trying to understand things and to create novelties from this deep understanding of how things are made.
Sharpening Up with Stettler, in the film section on Monocle.com.
If you're looking for a present for a loved one, something for the home, or some luggage to take on the road, why not visit one of our shops? Our beautifully appointed shops in London, New York, Toronto, Hong Kong, and Tokyo sell a selection of the fruits of our collaborations with a number of our favourite brands, including Porter, Hackett, Ettinger, Barena, and many others too. Plus, we can also help out filling in any gaps in your collection of back issues. So why not visit any of our shops today? You're guaranteed a very warm welcome.
Welcome back. It's Saturday afternoon. You're listening to The Review with me, Andrew Muller, and Clemency Burton-Hill on Monocle 24. Now, if you've ever read a book about Russia, chances are good that it's the most depressing book you've ever read and that it will remain so until next time you pick up a book about Russia. If demographic data is any guide, the centuries of snow, tyranny, and turnips are beginning to get to the Russians themselves. They drink more and more, reproduce less and less, and live shorter and shorter lives.
Well, despite all that, Oliver Bulow's new book, The Last Man in Russia, is an exploration of what causes a nation to give up that manages to be a luminous read. It chronicles the author's attempts to trace the life of a priest called Dmitry Dudko, who lived and died more or less contemporaneously with the Soviet Union. Dudko's life is an irresistible metaphor for Russia's modern history. He began as a fiery, spirited dissident and ended crushed by the KGB. Well, Oliver joins us here in the studio at Midori House now to discuss The Last Man in Russia and his choice of other books about the country. Welcome, Oliver. Thanks very much for joining us.
My pleasure.
Lovely to see you. What attracted you, first of all, to Dudko as a character?
Well, it's when you're writing anything about the Soviet Union, you're basically stuck dealing with the fact there are very few sources. So unless you're going to rely on official sources, which have got all sorts of sort of censorship issues and reliability issues, that means you've got to rely on what the dissidents publish themselves. And the problem with the dissidents, though most of them were eminently wonderful people, is that they only really wrote about what was happening in Moscow. And if you want to write about what's happening in the whole country, there are only two or three people. I mean, in fact, it's a lot of people have said to me, how did you find this extraordinary character? When actually there were only two or three characters I could have chosen. It was just a question of reading through what they'd written and then picking one of them. And essentially, as you say, it's a pretty depressing story. The backstory, which is that Russians drink too much, are psychologically very damaged and are sort of as a nation dying out as a result. And so I wanted to find a character who wasn't a hero. And that left me with only one option. So it was essentially a process of elimination. And then I settled on him. And then it was building it back up, because actually the more I read about this guy who I'd picked sort of by, default, the more I realized how extraordinarily perfect he was as a metaphor, as a real life metaphor for his entire nation, his experience, so closely mirrored what happened to all the Russians and to the Russian nation as a whole, that, I mean, the more I read about it, it was almost I couldn't believe I hadn't made this guy up. It was so perfect.
It's a lovely feeling, though, as any kind of journalist or non-fiction writer, when that character just drops into your lap that expresses everything that you feel like you want to say about a place. And the reason those characters exist is, of course, because those places exist. Your previous book, Let Our Fame Be Great, was a book about your travels in the Caucasus, so I guess around the periphery of Russia's empire. Did you notice, and you travelled a lot in Russia for this book, do they feel like very different places? Does the Caucasus feel like a very foreign country to Russia to you?
Well, I mean, this book actually very much grew out of the first book, and in a sort of almost a negative sense, which is that the first book, Russia does come out of it very badly. It is essentially a series of genocides. It is structured around a series of genocides. And it's difficult to write about a country that inflicts genocide on all of its neighbours without that country coming out of it pretty badly. And a lot of Russian friends of mine said to me, that they didn't dispute what I'd written, but they said that in a way it was a bit unfair to have left out the Russian side of the story, because Russia is quite unique among autocratic or dictatorial countries in that it oppressed its own people as much as it oppressed anyone else. There's no equivalent, say with Nazi Germany or whatever, that it was equally brutal and horrible to Russians as it was to Chechens or whoever. So this is an attempt in a way to redress the balance and to fill in the other half of the story, which is what happened with the Russians. And actually, what's interesting is when I finished researching the last book, I was pretty down on Russia as a whole. It seemed a pretty depressing place that had done all these horrible things. But actually, getting out of Moscow and out of the big towns into these, very out-of-the-way villages which were connected to Dmitry Dudko's life as I followed him, in west and north. And, I realized that all the hospitality and everything that I'd been praising as inherent parts of Chechen culture and saying, they're so amazing, no one else has anything like this. The Russians were exactly the same. I mean, the degree of hospitality I met was absolutely insane. I mean, I'd meet someone at a bus stop and that's taken care of for the next week. You know, we just, and they wouldn't let me pay for anything, and it was absolutely extraordinary. I mean, I fell back in love with Russia. I mean, it's actually kind of slightly unfortunate in that, as you say, it is, I think it has a happy ending, but it is essentially a fairly grim read. In the process of researching this grim read, I had the most astonishingly good time. I mean, it was absolutely wonderful.
Part of that hospitality, though, as I'm sure we've at least all experienced, is that, you know, a Muscovite might offer you a glass of vodka before breakfast even. And a lot of the culture is about drinking, and a big part of your book is looking at how, in many ways, this is still a country that's sort of drinking itself to death and not reproducing. And the rate of population is falling at a staggering rate, much, much faster than the rest of the West. How have you managed to find a glimmer of hope and redemption in that very bleak picture?
Well, I mean, essentially, in order to try and prevent this being a book about statistics, because if you write a book about demographics, you have inevitably got to deal with statistics. And there are, obviously, all the relevant statistics are in there, but that is a very different kind of book to the book I wanted to tell. So what I wanted was to get back to the root of why Russians started drinking so much. I mean, essentially, as you say, populations are falling in the West as well, but the reason they're falling in the West is we don't have many children. There are population problems in sub-Saharan Africa, and the reason of that is they die very young. In Russia, they have both of those things put together. It is a sort of third world death rates and first world birth rates, which is this, it's a sort of horrible double whammy. And it's actually a very difficult story to tell because everyone you want to interview has either not been born or drunk themselves to death. So you have to try and find a way around this. And in order to get behind, you know, where drinking ceases to be a social thing and becomes a pathological thing. And that's, you know, there is actually very little drinking in the book, written about in the book, though I did quite a lot of drinking while researching it. I didn't really focus on that as a pastime.
It is hard to avoid drinking in that part of the world. My experiences there don't compare with yours, but during one quite longish stay in Georgia and a second one in Abkhazia, I did become quite adept at subtly pouring vodka into my shoes when people weren't looking. Because if you try and keep up with them, it's not going to end well.
Well, I found a useful tactic is just to defer to them. Say, I'm a foreigner. I can't, I cannot do what you can do. And we're not real men.
Yeah, I've tried that one, but it all gets a bit force-feedy.
Yeah, no,
you're clearly such a real man, Andrew. Yeah. They can't possibly. Oliver, I mean, there's
that is a more charitable interpretation for which I thank you, though I don't believe it for a second.
Oliver, on that note, I have to turn to an excellent opening line in a review that you wrote for the Independent newspaper. Once during a long drunken evening, I had an argument with a Russian journalist. Feels like we could go anywhere from that line. This is about another book, Iron Curtain: The Crushing of Eastern Europe by Anne Applebaum. Tell us about, we're going to talk about some of the other books around the country and around the whole sort of Russian narrative. Why were you interested in this book in particular?
Well, it is, Anne Applebaum wrote, sort of slightly to go back in time, a book called Gulag, which was very useful for me in researching this book. It is an excellent, the book to read about the Russian system which it created to destroy its own people and to break the spirit of its own people, which is very much the story I tell in this. So it was very useful to me. And then in The Iron Curtain, she basically, in a way, writes a sequel. It's not actually a sequel, but it's sort of a thematic sequel in which she sort of then addresses the system that the Stalinist state created to crush its neighbours. And it's just a story which, though it's been told in bits here and there, it has never been told systematically in a sort of almost a how-to guide if you are a major, you know, superpower and you want to transform, a vibrant Eastern European rich society into a sort of Stalinist clone. This is how you do it. And it is, laying out the salami tactics and how they did it in, I mean, she focuses only on East Germany, Poland and Hungary. I mean, she doesn't deal with the other countries, but effectively the blueprint she lays out is the same for all of them. She writes extremely well. The story she tells is, you know, one which hasn't been told in this way before. And it is incredibly convincing. So, I mean, it's a model history book, really. And I mean, in a way, she sort of slightly surfs the frontier of history. You know, there's a lot of historians are a bit sniffy about anything that didn't happen a couple hundred years ago because, you know, all the sources haven't been revealed and you can't really be sure. So, I mean, a lot of historians would say, well, it's just journalism, you know, nonsense. It's modern history. It gets up to 1956. But, you know, it gives her this sort of, you know, free rein to do what she wants with the material. And also, I mean, she's got, you know, astonishing access. She's married to the Polish foreign minister. I mean, she, you know, she knows everyone. She's been working in the area for 20 years. You know.
How understood is that period in Russia now? I mean, the review you wrote of the book talks about the argument you had with the journalist, he advancing the idea, which I'm sure is still popular in Russia, the Soviet Union liberated Eastern Europe, whereas, of course, I think a great many Eastern Europeans would beg to differ with that adjective. How do Russians sort of see that period now? Because I know, again, from my very brief time I've spent in Russia, that the Great Patriotic War is still this thing that, as they call World War II, is still this thing that they cling to when they were good and they were victorious and they were strong. Have they kind of come to terms with what happened next?
Not at all. I mean, it's very difficult. This comes back to the issue of what happens if there is a dictatorship that is both happening on behalf of you and also oppresses you. Mm. You know, how do you separate out those two things? You are the great imperial nation and you're also a colonized nation. It's the same, this issue whereby, you know, there's no question that the Soviet Union won World War II in that their army won World War II, but it is a very different issue to say that the Soviet people won World War II, because they clearly ended up far worse off than any of the other countries that won World War II. And in fact, a lot of the army that won it ended up in the Gulag precisely because they'd won it, because they'd seen, you know, the sort of wealth and sort of dignity with which people lived in Germany or in Hungary or wherever. So it is this issue is something that Russians, I mean, have never reconciled themselves to. The fact that essentially, though Germany lost, if you look at Germany today, you would never guess that. Germany, you know, now is somewhere that Russians can only dream of having a country as prosperous, or Japan, or, you know, or the other countries that won, which Russians would consider to have been very much the junior partners in the war effort in Britain and America. And yet we're much better off than they are. So this is something they really struggle with.
There's another book you've chosen, which is, a fictional depiction of that very malaise. And this is the Banner of the Passing Clouds, a new novel on Granta by Anthea Nicholson. And she develops this conceit, I guess, of a narrator who was born the day that Stalin dies, and he shares by coincidence a surname with Stalin, Dzhugashvili, so his parents christen him Yosef, and he goes through life with, I guess, a budding reincarnation of the unlamented dictator trapped in his chest. What did you like about this?
Well, there is a sort of mini genre which I'm loving, which has been slightly growing up in British literature. There's Red Plenty by Francis Spufford, and then an absolutely superb book about Ceausescu's Romania called The Last 100 Days, which came out last year and I think won various prizes. And it is an examination of this period, which has sort of kind of been given up on by historians because it's sort of a bit whatever about it, which is after the 1960s, well, 1960s and onwards, when the Soviet Union ceased to be a realistic alternative for humanity's future and just became something that was about to die and was going to die, and everyone knew it was going to die and it would die eventually, so why bother writing about it? But, you know, for historians, this is very unsexy. They'd rather write about something else. But for novelists, it's an amazing period to talk about how you're still working and still forced to work by a system that is still strong enough to compel you to do what it wants, but not strong enough to change its course towards inevitable death. And her book, I thought, was beautifully written in a sort of slightly magical realist way. Very luminous, very sort of translucent and quite weird, in which he has this, you know, belief that Stalin lives in his stomach, which you're never really sure if it's just sort of horrible hallucination, really.
Probably would give you indigestion.
But it does. This is the thing. I mean, anything when there's any rumbling in his stomach, he blames it on Stalin. And occasionally Stalin comes out and walks around. And it's this thing whereby for Georgians, I mean, it's rotten because there is only one famous Georgian and it's Stalin. And even Austria at least has Arnold Schwarzenegger.
And actually the runner-up Lavrentiy Beria is not a guy you boast about either.
Well, yeah, this is it. I mean,
you're just about to say Austria at least has Arnold Schwarzenegger.
Well, Austria had Hitler. At least it gets Mozart and Arnold Schwarzenegger as well. So, I mean, there is sort of there is another famous Austrian. Georgia doesn't even have that. So they have this thing of, are we proud of this guy? I mean, at least he's famous, you know. But he's also one of the biggest monsters who ever lived. And it encapsulates that difficulty, which is also very well.
Oliver Bullough, thank you very much for joining us. Oliver's new book, The Last Man in Russia, The Struggle to Save a Dying Nation, which is terrific, is out on April the 4th. And that brings us to the end of our Saturday review. It's goodbye from all of us here at Midori House. The show today was produced by Katie Bilboa and researched by Fernando Augusto Pacheco and Ed Lucas. Our studio manager was Alex Funnell.
We'll be handing back over to Georgina with a weekend edition next, where you can catch our pick of the week's best Monocle 24 stories, guests and features on The Curator. And don't forget to tune in to the
Monocle Weekly, which will be on air on Sunday at midday London time with Robert Bound and Steve Bloomfield. They'll be joined by the editors of Middle Eastern magazine Brown Book and discussing the history of sound with broadcaster and academic David Hendy.
But for now, you've been listening to The Review with me, Andrew Muller.
And me, Clemency Burton-Hill. Have a great weekend.
A Rolex timepiece represents an ongoing commitment to innovation, horological expertise, and the passion of skilled watchmakers. All add up to make the one principle by which Rolex lives, that greatness is a journey that never ends. Rolex.